Welcome, everyone, to Season 2 of Bleeding Edge. My name is Bethann Stubbe, and I'm the Director of Publications and Press, and my amazing co-host is Cindy McBean. Today, we sit down with Benjamin Aleri. He is over at Blue Jay. Welcome, both.
Thanks, Bethann.
Ben, can you describe your journey at a high level from IBM Watson Challenge to present, the technology enhancements to providing services to legal and financial professionals? I know that's a lot, so please take your time.
Well, I'm going to try to give you the short version here, Bethann. Blue Jay really is coming out of my experiences as a law professor at the University of Toronto. I've been teaching tax law predominantly at the law school here at the University of Toronto since 2004. There was an IBM Watson Challenge in 2014 that I became aware of. I was associate dean of the faculty of the law school here, and there was this challenge happening over in the computer science department. The dean of the law school was invited to participate because most of the entries of the University of Toronto in this Watson Challenge were oriented towards law. And that just so happened to be the focus of our local computer science team. And they wanted somebody from the law school to be a judge. So the dean wasn't able to make it that day. I ended up over at the computer science department sitting on a judging panel with folks from IBM and folks from the computer science department. And I became enthralled with the idea of using technology in law. And the more I thought about it, the more I became convinced that this is really going to be the future. And so I immediately set to work to put together a special seminar at the university with students from the computer science department, from the law school, even from the business school, Rotman. And so beginning in January 2015, we set to put ourselves to work to figure out a way to predict legal outcomes using AI. And it was really slow going. It was really hard. And we didn't produce a very workable system for many months. It wasn't until the fall of 2015 that we really had some technical breakthroughs. And suddenly we were able to predict legal outcomes in new cases with greater than 90% accuracy. And it was at that point that was really clear that we had something that might be commercially interesting. And so Blue Jay was founded by me and two of my professor colleagues from the University of Toronto. And from there, one thing has led to another. And now we're at several dozens of employees across North America. We have some really marquee clients in the forms of government and big professional services firms. And it's been really quite a journey over the past 6+ years to take it from inception to where Blue Jay is now. But I still think of this as the very, very beginning of predicting legal outcomes using tech.
That's a really awesome path. I can't even, Cindy.
It is. And my history is with law firms, although I do have some time in corporate legal and with a DOJ litigation support service provider. And so, you know, my focus is always on working within law firms and, you know, lawyers in law firms, and especially in some practice areas, the words, you know, quote, innovative technology, unquote, would not be enticing at all. And so, you know, you've talked about your path and it sounds fascinating, and I can see how the path in your mind might have developed, but, you know, what influenced you to also seek the path of innovative technology?
So I think this is a bigger part of the backstory, but at the time I was an associate dean, I was co-chairing a committee that was looking to innovate in the first year curriculum of the JD program. So the backstory here is that at the law school at the University of Toronto, there hadn't been a really major change to the first year curriculum since I think the early 1970s was the last time there had really been a really careful look at all the components of the first year program and how we're actually training law students. And so that was very top of mind to me. And it was that combined with this thinking about technology and then thinking about, well, this is all going to change radically in the next decade, in the next two decades, in the next three decades. We should be thinking about a curriculum that will stand the test of time and resist the technological changes that are inevitably going to come very soon. And then I thought further about, well, I could be part of this change. I could really throw myself into it and be part of it. If it's inevitable, my choices really struck me as being staying at the law school as a faculty member, teaching my classes and writing articles and co-authoring books and authoring monographs and clinging to my chalk in the classroom, or throwing myself into this really interesting adventure that I regard as completely inevitable with exponential growth in computing power and the reduced cost and the increased availability of digital legal information and the improved algorithms. So there's a lot of talk about AI and machine learning improvements, and a lot of that research is happening in Toronto. Toronto's a hotbed of advancements in AI. Deep learning was invented in Toronto. And so it's kind of in the environment here. And so all of those things are to different extents were influences on wanting to get on this path. I guess mostly it was about not wanting to find myself in 2040 clinging to my chalk and wishing that I would have been bold enough to make a leap into pursuing something along these lines. I really just didn't want to have that career regret later.
And as you thought about whether or not this was going to be commercially viable, was there any kind of trajectory change? I know you were a tax professor, and so, you know, tax law is a logical place to begin. Also, it's numbers driven. But did your trajectory change as you kind of looked at the market to assess the capacity for what you had in mind?
Yes, it's changed in a couple of different ways. One of the really interesting things that we were noticing when we started out is in tax law, you really have two different kinds of professional services firms that are using tax research services and needing to get to the bottom of what a particular tax situation may call for. And so those are the big CPA firms, the big accounting firms, and law firms. And a third party obviously involved in the tax system is the government. And so that starting point was very solid, very interesting. As we got into it, we noticed that there were subtle differences in what accounting firms were interested in, what law firms were interested in, what the government was interested in a solution like the ones that we were building. And so each of those different segments influenced how we built the product in different ways. And they show different kinds of interest in different elements of the product. But the product is stronger as a result of these different elements coming together. So that's kind of at a high level. And then the product has kind of changed and evolved over time. We've added functionality that caters to each of these different groups in varying measures. And so I don't think I want to get into all the specific details. It's probably too nitty gritty for our conversation today. But one big way in which we learned from the market is in very early on in our conversation with some of the big law firms, we started to see the knowledge managers at those firms inviting folks from the labor and employment law groups to come and learn about BlueJay, which I found really curious. And I asked, why are you inviting the labor and employment lawyers? And they said, well, one of the things that you have in your platform is this predictor that will tell someone whether, based on the facts of a situation, whether that worker is an independent contractor or an employee. And we know that the BlueJay predictor is trained on all of the tax case law, but we thought it would be extremely interesting for the labor and employment lawyers here who are dealing with these issues fairly routinely to find out about what you've built. And so we hope you don't mind that they're coming to learn about it, because we think it's really relevant for the work that we're doing. And I said, no, of course, this is great. Love to let everybody in on what we're up to. And then it started to develop into more of an insistent conversation where the labor and employment groups are saying, This is really great. Can you please build a predictor like the one that you've built for the tax solution, but trained on the employment law that we have? So the cases that we have decided, so that we're not getting the prediction of what the tax court would do. We're more interested in the prediction of what the other courts would do in these worker classification cases. And we said, okay. And we set to work on it. And within several months, we'd built a labor and employment solution trained on Canadian labor and employment law. And that's been really successful for us too. And so listening to the market in that way has been really, really helpful in figuring out the directions, not only within the tax product where we've built things like our decision finder and our diagramming solution and certain predictive modules to address government work or the work that the big accounting firms are doing, and also certain predictive elements that are really, really helpful for law firms, but also, you know, standing up entirely new products.
Great. And, you know, at this point, I would be remiss if I didn't ask you if you've seen any strategic changes in the past 2 years with all the, for lack of a better word, shenanigans that's been going on as far as where people are working, how they're working, and all of that, plus, you know, tax implications. So has there been any kind of shift or anything that's really led you to change direction in the past couple of years regarding practice areas?
That's an interesting question. I mean, one of the ways in which the pandemic has really influenced our product direction is in encouraging us to think more about collaboration in the platform. With everybody working remotely, there is now much greater interest in figuring out technologically how to facilitate people working on the same matters, on the same files. And so what we are seeing in our platform is a movement towards more significant collaboration across the feature sets to work with folks who are, as you're saying, working quite remotely and in different places. It's interesting how different governments have responded. State governments have responded to the remote work environment and things like payroll withholding. And a lot of the compliance efforts have been subject of relief by the state, saying we're not going to enforce strictly, you know, during the pandemic. I expect a lot of that stuff to get unwound, and I think we're gonna see a bunch of legal change on that front very soon. And so that's an area that could be ripe for solution using technology like BlueJays for sure.
In my experience with litigation support and discovery management in the U.S., where, you know, we have a lot of effort and cost is built around human lawyers reviewing documents compared with the different predictive technologies. So how does the computer-based predictions compare to legal analysis by human lawyers in your product and for your purposes? And then what are the benefits and then the differences of that whole dynamic for you?
Right. I think they're highly complementary processes. So the traditional way that we teach law students to do legal research and how we've traditionally taught legal research and writing is, you know, you start with your problem, you go to some more general sources, you identify some leading appellate cases, you go to those cases, you read those cases, maybe you follow whatever subsequent cases have cited those leading appellate cases, and you work your way through a chain of precedent. And hopefully along the way, you're discovering cases that have facts that are similar to the facts of the situation that you're analyzing. Or if it's a legislative problem, you know, you'll look at the legislation, you look at the legislative history, you'll approach your legislation interpretation exercise by looking at how different courts have interpreted and applied that particular provision that you're looking at. That's all kind of standard way of doing research. Folks using BlueJay, we kind of turn that research process on its head. You identify the issue. So I spoke earlier about worker classification. So let's stay with that one. That one's a nice illustration of this. If I know that the active legal question that I'm thinking about is this worker properly treated as an employee, or should they be treated as an independent contractor? If you start doing research on that question, you'll find secondary sources, a bunch of cases talking about worker classification and going into the specifics of a very complicated, often, and messy situation where there are a bunch of factors that point in one way and a bunch of factors that point in the other way. And so you would have to read a lot of cases to come up with a well-informed intuition about which way a court would go on the particular factors of your client's situation. Using BlueJay, it's very different. You select the worker classification predictor, and it will ask you approximately 30 factual questions about the worker's situation, the situation of the hirer, the working conditions, who's controlling the work. And it's very specific in the questions that it asks. On the basis of the questions that it asks you, it will produce a prediction based on all of the case law on worker classification and make a prediction based on a synthesis of that and tell you with a certain percentage confidence whether that worker would be treated as an employee or independent contractor. So the result might say 88% independent contractor, and it comes up also with a list of the most similar cases on the facts to the facts as you presented them to the system. It gives you a plain language explanation of why that's the outcome, and it links to the most relevant authorities. So at that point, if you are the researcher, you have a lot of information available to you to go deeper, but you also have an incredibly strong starting point. So you've got a starting point that's 93% or 94% accurate. If the answers to the questions that you've given to BlueJay are the same as the answers that a judge would agree to or decide upon in forming their findings of fact, you're already on second base in your analysis. Now what you need to do is go and identify cases that are friendly to your situation, which you can do using that result screen. You can also find the ones that are potentially challenging for your position, again, on their specific facts. You can filter in a whole bunch of ways. So it just takes you very quickly to a very defensible answer to that particular client situation. It really frees you up to do the deeper digging on precisely the sorts of issues, factual considerations that you should be digging deeper into, rather than reading around specific aspects that of cases that are probably idiosyncratic and potentially in many cases of limited relevance to the particular context of your client. So it's massively time saving and getting you to the part of the process where the lawyer can really add a ton of value to the analysis. And that's where they get into the nitty gritty of working the facts, working the evidence, working the case law, distinguishing the case law, and those sorts of things.
So in my world, when we talk to attorneys about, you know, increasing what I call quality billables and decreasing the more rote work, when we talk about, you know, deploying technology, you know, the applying of the technology is done at different stages. And as you just described so well, there's a big change at the first step of the process when using predictive technology, just because of the way it works. Do you find when you're talking to people and when they see your technology, is there an aha moment, or do you find there's a little bit of a learning curve so that users can see the potential and then they can, you know, kind of follow the logical path to more quality billables?
I think people, it's kind of like an iPhone. People pick it up and they intuit how to use it. They understand it and they want to use it. So it's pretty intuitive for users. And I think the resistance, to the extent that we get it, the resistance is, you know, I think a fear-based one, because they see in the results that the system produces something that they fear others might just take as the be-all and end-all, right? But that's not the right way to think about what we're doing. It really is a very good starting point for your analysis. And so it's not an endpoint at all. But sometimes folks see it and they're supremely impressed. They go, wow, that's incredible. I can see how that would be useful. But then they start to think things like, well, what if that result isn't that friendly for my client? that, you know, now how do I unsee that? And of course, that's not the right answer. The right answer, the right reaction should be, oh, that's curious. I wonder why that is. So you're much better off knowing that the client may have an unforeseen issue with something rather than remaining, you know, in the dark about that potentiality. And if it is friendly for the client, then often they go, okay, yeah, that's good. Can we print that off? Can I save that PDF? And of course we have that functionality, but it's really meant as a research support tool, something to really facilitate research. And if we can communicate that very clearly to attorneys when they're getting exposed to it, it makes a world of difference, because then they understand, okay, here's how I get to an initial result screen, but that's just the beginning of the analysis. That's not the end of the analysis. Now I can change different facts and circumstances, see how that influences the result. I can really start combing through the case law, finding cases that I should be spending more time with to increase my comfort with the position. And what we see with our customers is that there's an increase in quality billable hours there, and they're able to produce a better work product and write off significantly less research time and actually bill more time from using this solution. And so people like it, they know how to use it, and when they think about what they're doing with it in the right way, they really see its potential for their practices.
That is great. In looking at the adoption of the technology, are there differences in the adoption? I know that you have the Canadian tax and then the US tax, and then you've got the employment and HR attorney areas. So with the tax groups, are you feeling, what is your differences in adoption in the technology between the CPA or the accounting firms and then the tax lawyers that you're finding?
Yeah, it's interesting. My experience so far is that the accounting firms, there's no question, if a technology exists that is beneficial to their work, they understand that very quickly, and they are very keen to pilot it and subscribe to it. If it's adding value to the work that they're doing, they are very aggressive about adopting it. What's interesting about the law firms is there's just a different eagerness to adopt technology that I'm seeing. Look, the attorneys are extremely well-trained, extremely intelligent. They're also extremely busy, so it can be hard to get time to showcase new technologies to them. Of course, we're working through that, and different firms have different appetites for new technology. The tax groups at big law firms are really curious about what we're doing. We're getting invited in by many of them to showcase the technology, explain to them how it works, and we're seeing adoption. But the big CPA firms, the big accounting firms are really into the technology and know that they really need to have it. If it exists, they definitely want it. And so I would say the big CPA firms are faster than the big law firms in adopting the technology. And it's not attributable to any one thing. I think the big accounting firms are just much bigger in scope, and so their technology budgets are often significantly bigger. They also have a slightly different inclination to want to invest in technology just natively. They also are paired with consultancies, and the consultancies at the big accounting firms spend a lot of time explaining to other businesses, other corporations, why they should be embracing technology and, you know, investing in process improvement and those sorts of things. And so it really has become second nature for those accounting firms to adopt the technology.
Great. And when we talk about the predictive process, it kind of relies on scenarios that you are either documents that you submit or scenarios that you kind of select and type in. What are the key success factors in outlining the scenarios for the program and making predictive analysis?
Yeah, so there's a ton of work that goes into what we would call feature engineering. So feature engineering involves reading, you know, essentially all of the case law, all of the secondary materials, publications relating to a particular predictor, and then identifying those facts that feed into the elements of the prevailing legal test for a different issue, and then going through and spending a ton of time crafting questions and figuring out just how we're going to elicit that information from users. So there's a ton of work that goes into that feature engineering process by our legal research team. So we have a legal research team with dozens of folks on it who are, many of whom are lawyers, legally trained, and they're responsible for curating the data sets, collecting the data, doing a bunch of that feature engineering work. And then in tandem with the data scientists on our team, putting together the machine learning models that really operate the predictive components of the software. And so it's a massive amount of work that requires careful reading, careful thinking, and then, you know, working iteratively towards maximizing the predictability of outcomes in these different areas using, again, feature engineering, which can boil down to, again, let's return to the worker classification context, things like, does the worker have to wear a specific kind of uniform? Does the worker set her own hours of work? Is the worker free to turn down work from the hirer? Questions like that. So very specific factual questions that then allow us to synthesize and tie together all of the cases that we're able to locate. So for most of these predictors, we have literally hundreds and hundreds of cases that we are laboriously working through, cataloging the information, and that's the basis. Those really explicit big data sets of information are the raw information that forms the basis of the machine learning model. So this boils down to, as you were suggesting, good feature engineering and a lot of, you know, sweat of the brow work to put these things together. But the whole idea is, if we're doing this once very carefully and iterating to the best possible machine learning model, it saves everybody a ton of time going forward in the future who can rely on the BlueJay system to get insight into what the entirety of the case law requires and query the database and find those cases that are going to be helpful. So really starting with a ground up way of mapping out what the case law requires on tons of different issues in tax and employment law and eventually beyond.
You know, in my experiences in introducing technology to an established process, there's any number of barriers to entry. What are the challenges in presenting an automated process to an established methodology have you encountered, and how does that compare and weigh in with the benefits to kind of remove those barriers?
I think one starting point here is I'm not sure that I would describe what we're doing as an automated process. Sure, it automates the first part of that research process, and it definitely streamlines that, and it gets people very quickly to a position for them to be, you know, starting the clock on those quality billable hours. I think if you describe, and I think you could describe that first part as being an automated process, getting them into the pocket so they can start, you know, charging those quality billable hours. If that's how it's presented, there are very few challenges to it. If you present it as an automated process, hey, we're going to make you redundant, or we're going to replace you with this algorithm, of course that's going to trigger like serious resistance. And so I think it's extremely important that folks understand this is how we kind of get your information in front of you that you can then work on and really do the high quality, high value add work that you can do as a researcher, as an attorney in these areas. And to that extent, you know, the automated aspect of the process is totally great. It's like setting up the operation room, the OR for a surgeon, right? That's kind of what we're doing. We're putting everything together, all the tools that you're going to need in front of you to perform your surgery. We're not going to do the surgery for you. It's up to you to actually do the analysis, confront the sticky parts of the situation, really figure out how to respond to the different elements. But what we'll do is we'll set the table with everything that you need to do the work that you want to do. And so there's no, as far as I know, there are no objections on the part of surgeons to others preparing the OR. I don't think surgeons necessarily want to go in and do that instrument setup and sanitization themselves. And I kind of think of what we're doing as the same way. We're simply setting the table, setting up the OR so that the really high valued specialists can go in and do the high margin work that we want them to do.
Thank you again for talking us through the predictive technologies. And in just looking towards 2022, you know, what's next for predictive technologies that we use in legal and or the tax arena that you're seeing?
I think what we're going to see is a continuation of new applications of predictive technology. So yes, we have them in tax law. Yes, we have them in employment law. I think we're going to see them in additional areas of law. I think we're going to see increased collaboration in these tools, which is interesting and exciting. And we're going to see new creativity in the way that information gets collected for making these predictions. So for example, in BlueJay, we have recently introduced a diagramming component of the platform where you can, if you're putting together a series of charts of a particular organizational structure with different entities and different relationships amongst those entities for tax planning purposes for a transaction, we can use those diagrams to form the factual basis of a predictive exercise and identify pitfalls in a particular structure or transaction, identify tax optimizing opportunities in that structure. And so we're going to see increasingly interesting ways of getting input into these predictive systems, different forms of output, and more collaboration in these systems as they become more mainstream and become more widely adopted.
I am really looking forward to see how all that happens and how predictive technology advances. At this point, I would like to thank you for your time. And Beth Ann, do you want to close out the podcast for me?
Well, I've learned a lot. Thank you, Ben. And thank you, Cindy, for such an exhilarating conversation. This was with BlueJay and Benjamin Aleri. Thank you guys so much. And we'll speak to you soon.
Thank you.